You know, something that we've recognized for many years is, you know, a lot of the people who are promoting these policies, taking away products, safer products, making it harder for companies to get their products on the market, their guiding star is complete nicotine eradication. You know, I think you and I both agree, and a lot of us, you know, in this conversation agree that, you know, heavy-handed bans don't work. They result in illicit markets, which make things more risky for any consumer of any age.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Vaping Unplugged podcast. Everything you need to know about vaping and tobacco harm reduction.
I'm Michael, and today I will discuss with Alex Clark from CASA the current harm reduction situation in the U.S. CASA is a consumer advocacy organization, and they want to give consumers more voice and more saying when it comes to regulatory updates in the U.S. They work on flavor bans, PMTA madness, nicotine-free generation, how to deal with disposables. And in the following half an hour, we will discuss all these issues, what's going on in the U.S., what consumers can do, and how to change the situation. Enjoy the episode and take care. Hello and welcome, Alex, to Vaping Unplugged, the World Vapers Alliance podcast. Thank you for joining us, and how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Great pleasure. Before we get into the policy side, maybe you can give us a quick intro of who are you and what is CASA's mission and what are you doing?
Sure. Well, I am Alex Clark, as the label states at the bottom there. I am the CEO of the Consumer Advocates for Smoke-Free Alternatives Association. We've been around since 2009. The organization was formed by a group of consumers on a message board people might be familiar with, e-cigarette forum. And it was formed in response to FDA seizing shipments of e-cigarettes coming in from overseas. And immediately people realized, you know, voice needed to be just typically by, you know, public health versus big industry. And so we really, you know, up until the vaping thing came along, consumers were not really adequately represented in policy debates about tobacco and nicotine. I joined the organization in 2014 as a volunteer. And so I've been doing this for just over 10 years. And, you know, in that time, we've certainly engaged our consumer membership here in the United States. We've been successful, I think, at holding back or at least delaying some of the worst of the regulations, which, you know, means a lot. Even a delay means a lot for people accessing these products and businesses staying open. Of course, our main focus is on the consumers. And also, I think, you know, we've helped, you know, carry the torch in elevating the voice of consumers in, you know, not just at conferences, but at, you know, how the FDA goes about this, how researchers go about soliciting the experiences of consumers in using these products and switching away from combustible cigarettes. So it's been a really long slog. It's going to continue to be a long slog. But I think we've accomplished some of our goals in the past like 15 years now.
I mean, it's a very sad state of affairs when we have to say nothing new is better than most of the new things are coming, but unfortunately that's the way it is nowadays. Yeah. If you look back at the last 10 years, what do you think changed in the US? Because from the outside, I remember we always championed the US as one of the harm reduction leaders, and I think it kind of still is when we look at the numbers. But the public perception, and especially the perception from most policymakers, completely changed in the last few years. What went wrong there?
Well, I can go all the way back to 2019. You know, we had the so-called EVALI, the misnamed, the poorly named e-cigarette and vaping associated lung injuries, and this, of course, was coming from illicit THC cartridges that were adultered and used the vitamin E acetate, which is not an ingredient found in nicotine products. And I think, the evidence sort of shows that a lot of the anti-tobacco harm reduction campaigns sort of leveraged the public's misunderstanding of these products and, use that to foment fear and uncertainty about vaping. And so we have a lot of lawmakers and most of the public who have not really received the updates. It's not, our CDC, Centers for Disease Control, hasn't really taken an active campaign at correcting misperceptions of risk. So we still have something like 60% of people believing that nicotine causes cancer. I think a majority of people believing that e-cigarettes are just as harmful as smoking. Those misperceptions of risk have endured, and it made things worse. It wasn't like a complete 180 from where the public was prior to 2019, but it hasn't helped things that our health agencies haven't done their own campaigns to change misperceptions of risk, even though they have recently, I'd say over the past year or two, committed to changing misperceptions of risk. So, I hate to say it so enthusiastically, but looking forward to see what FDA is going to do in terms of informing people. And CDC obviously needs to pick up the slack here as well. But that was the big thing. The broader tobacco harm reduction conversation, nicotine pouches have become very popular here. I think a lot of us are sort of bracing to see kind of a Juul 2.0 scenario where a lot of the usual suspects that we saw promoting misinformation and fear about vaping will be doing the same thing for nicotine pouches. When you put things on that continuum of risk, nicotine pouches are even, it's sort of negligible, but measurably less harmful than even vaping, because you're not inhaling anything. It all just stays right up here. Those are the big things that we're looking out for. But again, this is just, people have just doubled down on leveraging people's misperception of risk. And that's through all levels of society, from government on down to, your average consumer buying nicotine in a convenience store.
Yeah, and I mean, what always baffles me is if we then look at the actual numbers, or in other words, at reality, the U.S. is seeing the first smoke-free generation. I think with under 24-year-olds, it's below 5% already, the smoking rate. And all the same groups, they are not celebrating it. Nobody knows about it. Nobody cares about it. We only hear about, some other products are used now. And no mention about the actual risks. And if I would be an anti-smoking organization, then I would definitely celebrate it and say, this is what we did. But apparently now the goal switched completely from reducing risk or harms from smoking to fighting nicotine in all forms, which doesn't make much sense to me. Or do I misread the situation there?
No, you've got it. We haven't seen the health groups really celebrating the gains that we've seen in the past 10 or 20 years. Anybody looking at a chart, it's some sort of graph of use prevalence will see from 2013 forward, we saw dramatic declines or at least accelerated declines in smoking prevalence, I think across almost all age groups, with the exception of, I think, people over the age of 60, who could really benefit from switching to smoke-free products. It's remarkable. And I think one way to look at it is, having the problem solved doesn't raise donations. And so every time we see, I saw it in my local paper here, I think it was probably last year, was when we started seeing youth smoking rates down below 5%, or having, been cut in half from the previous National Youth Tobacco Survey, whatever it was, tremendous gains, but still, editorial boards of local and national newspapers are still bemoaning the fact that anyone is still using nicotine. And still, I think, you know, my local paper, the Press Republican up here in Northern New York, you know, had a very shaming approach to encouraging people to quit smoking. It was very stigmatizing. There was no empathy, no compassion, basically called, you know, people who were smoking a bunch of idiots, which isn't fair and doesn't help people out. It is bizarre that people would not be celebrating this and getting behind promoting safer alternatives. But again, I think this comes down to, you know, it's kind of a money issue, which is unfortunate. Not a public health issue.
And the goalposts keep shifting.
To add to what you were saying, you know, something that we've recognized for many years is, you know, a lot of the people who are promoting these policies, taking away products, safer products, making it harder for companies to get their products on the market, their guiding star is complete nicotine eradication. You know, I think you and I both agree, and a lot of us, you know, in this conversation agree that, you know, heavy-handed bans don't work. They result in illicit markets, which make things more risky for any consumer of any age. It's just, you know, the horse is out of the barn. We're not going to go back in time and erase nicotine consumption from the planet. And the best way that we can improve public health is to learn to live with this and make it as low risk as possible for people to use what is a very useful drug.
Yeah, it would be like somebody trying to eradicate caffeine use or something like that. It might be wishful thinking, but probably not reality. And when we go into the specific arguments nowadays, I think internationally it's mainly two topics which are always discussed at the moment. It's flavor bans and disposables. I would like to start with the first one, namely disposable vapes, because I have the feeling that is not such a big issue in the US compared to other countries, or is it also on the table for disposable vape bans and those kind of things?
Oh, it's absolutely on the table. I think more than half the market in the United States is made up of disposable single-use products that are, some of them are not going through the review process. I think others, I don't know where manufacturers are with their applications, but and you can just, you know, I'm not going to name names, mostly because I don't know where companies are with their applications, but I know that some of them are. So you can go through some of the top brands that are being sold here in the US and around the world, and they are probably going through the process. They just haven't made it all the way through yet, largely because flavors other than tobacco. Fortunately, in the U.S., we did have at least one menthol vapor product authorized. That was an Enjoy product. So some movement there. Unfortunately, it's only consistent with FDA's thinking in terms of how do we ban menthol cigarettes, which will come with its own problems. The disposables have really taken over the market. We see a lot of resentment from some of the open system manufacturers who are having to compete with foreign companies that aren't necessarily following the rules. And so they're getting around the regulations. They're relying on the illicit market to sell their products. I live in New York State, as I mentioned, and we've had flavors banned here since I think 2021. You can still buy, you can find what you need out there on the illicit market in, you know, legal regulated stores. So a lot of this is sort of an unfair competition angle for U.S. manufacturers, absolutely understandable. Coming from the majors, you know, your Altria, Reynolds, they have been promoting legislation around the country that would knock out a lot of the products that people are using. These are products that don't have either a court-ordered stay against a marketing denial order, or they don't have an application pending with FDA, or they haven't received authorization. It leaves roughly, it's a little over 1,500 products if you go by the vapor directory in Alabama. But again, you know, people people want more variety. It's astonishing even to say like, well, 1500 products isn't enough, but for some people it's not. And you know, their favorite flavor, their favorite nicotine strength, their favorite form factor is something that isn't on that list. And compared with them going back to cigarettes, it makes sense to allow them to have those products. And so that's, you know, why CASA was opposed to these vapor directory bills around the country. We saw, I think, in 23 or 26 states, this effort from the large tobacco companies, and I think minimal success last year. We expect to see those things come back. And a lot of the lobbying around support for these bills comes from sort of China phobia. And it's a lot of, you know, everything is manufactured in China, even products that have made it through market authorization. And the whole thing is sort of bizarre to me, where, you know, you would have people supporting these policies talking about how we need more enforcement. States are going to have to spend more money enforcing these bills, basically doing legwork for the FDA. And yet there seems to be there's this disconnect between tightening the regulations and seeing the illicit market flourish and even, you know, get even further underground, and still, you know, promoting these things as if we're going to solve this with heavier enforcement. That it just, it keeps this cycle going of products being sold illegally and putting consumers at risk. So it is very much an issue here, and not just in terms of sort of that unfair competition that American companies are experiencing, but in terms of waste. These are products that, you know, the U.S. doesn't have a very well-developed, easy-to-access recycling program. Depending on where you are, you may be able to recycle certain things. You may not be able to recycle things. There are a lot of e-waste transfer type stations where people can go, but you have to, as the consumer, you have to do your own research, and it could take multiple sources and a lot of time to figure out where you need to take things. Strongly encourage anybody in the U.S. to do that research. It depends on where you are. It can be a municipality by municipality thing. Your state may have a more organized system, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to address the waste associated with single-use products. And of course, if this is something to you, I'm still open the open system route, because it generates significantly less waste than the single-use products.
But on this issue, can't it be also argued that the bad regulation in the first place even led to the explosion of disposables? Because when flavors were banned in pod systems, then companies started to produce disposables, because there they could still put flavors in. So it's not like this is coming out of nowhere. It's all, again, regulation where nobody thought about unintended consequences.
Yeah, and I think the correct way to sort of talk about it is, what happened was, I forget the year, but this was during the Trump administration. There was sort of a perceived loophole created in the enforcement priorities of FDA, and that basically left all of the disposable products relatively untouched. But it's important for people to remember that everything that hasn't gone through pre-market authorization is considered illegal in a way. And so FDA has always had the opportunity to enforce against all of the products. But yes, that perceived loophole did create an opportunity for people to sell the disposable products. This all goes back to how FDA is regulating things and creating this bottleneck, making it harder for people to bring products to market. It's created a situation where manufacturers, there's money laying on the table, and they are going to get around the regulations to make that money. Anything in terms of products being seized by customs, you know, that's just spillage. Those are things that companies will account for. We see the same thing in the drug war, which is an absolute failure. And there's no reason to apply that thinking to nicotine or any other drug.
And this fact that basically everything not approved is illegal, doesn't that apply to flavors as well? So why do states still implement flavor bans then, since they are technically banned anyways? Is that just marketing?
No, it's about enforcement. I can't remember the population at the Center for Tobacco Products, the number of employees. I think it's like 800 or 900 people. There's a limit to what FDA can do in terms of enforcement. A lot of people who get caught, they get a nasty gram from FDA that says, you need to stop selling this product. You have 15 days to, give us a letter telling us how you're going to correct this issue. If you don't correct it, there are monetary penalties. So there's sort of a process that FDA has to go through in order to enforce against people. If you take the state laws and conform them to the federal standard, which would be what we saw with the vapor directory bills, now the state officials can get involved. And so your state and local health departments, state and local law enforcement can get involved in shutting down shops and issuing fines. And so it's just about, more enforcement. And that's why states do need to do it. We still have, I don't have a list in my head, but I'm sure there are some states that still haven't raised the minimum legal sales age to 21. Even though that is federal law, states will need to pass their own law in order to issue fines and penalties and so on. So that's really what it is. It's the states picking up slack for FDA.
Makes sense. And now we are 20 minutes in and everything was a bit negative, but now we need to switch to the positives. Since we talk to a lot of consumers, what do you think can consumers do and should do, especially if they are in the US, to change that? You have an election in less than a month. What can we expect there, and what influence do vapors actually have there, or do we even have influence there?
Well, I, as individuals, the greatest thing that we have is being registered to vote and actually getting out and voting. Other than our own personal stories and our voice, which we encourage people to share all of the time. But it's important. Make sure you are registered to vote and then actually go out and vote. In sort of preparing for this conversation, the one thing that I think we have to acknowledge is there may be a lot of people out there who don't feel that they can vote for either presidential candidate. Don't let that keep you away from the polls. All the down ballot races are very important, especially when we're talking about things like your city council members, mayor, your state officials, and people in Congress in D.C. It's very important to get out and vote, and your officials can't see how you vote, but they can see whether or not you vote. And that's very important when you are writing letters, when you're making phone calls, when you're showing up to campaign events. You can start what you're about to say with, I am a registered voter and I vote, and that will get their attention, whether you're saying it or writing it. And so that's very important. And we've seen over the years, I think you could probably go through the numbers and see where people have voted. And you can say one party's better on this issue than the other, but not by much. People on the left and right have misperceptions of risk. Both sides have been listening to a bunch of garbage when it comes to information about these products. And so we've seen attacks from both sides of the aisle. So it's not enough to say, just go vote, a straight ticket for this party and vaping will be fine. That's not the case. It depends on where you live. So in addition to making sure you're registered to vote and going out and voting, go to these campaign events. Candidates will have a stop at a local diner or coffee shop, or maybe they'll do some sort of town hall kind of event, or their own rallies. And if you have the opportunity to ask questions, ask them, what they know about tobacco harm reduction. What do they know about vaping? What do they know about nicotine pouches? Give them some statistics. We've seen in the past few years, youth smoking has dropped below 5%. As you said at the top, we're looking at the first smoke-free generation in the United States. Probing them, asking them, important questions about what they understand about this issue, that can help inform you and everybody else listening as to where they might stand on this issue. One specific note, we are seeing efforts in Massachusetts at the municipal level. Unfortunately, the people making these decisions are on local boards of health, which are not elected officials. There may or may not be some influence in terms of other elected officials, but local boards of health around Massachusetts are now pushing the nicotine-free generation laws, which I'm sure I know that has come up a lot in Europe. This idea that we're going to pick a date and anybody born after that date will not be able to buy any nicotine product. So that's an effort that we're seeing, and we anticipate being a little bit more engaged in that in Massachusetts in the coming weeks or months. Also, stuff at the municipal level. Right now we're looking at Kansas City, Missouri is entertaining a flavor ban. So again, make sure you get out to vote for all the down ballot races. You're choosing a different city council member or supporting the one you've got could make the difference between a state or local flavor ban.
But you're right, it would be so much easier if just one party would be pro-vaping, the other party against it, and then you know how to vote. But unfortunately, reality is a bit more complicated. And obviously, CASA is here to help consumers navigate through all of this. Maybe at the end, you let listeners and viewers know how to reach you personally and CASA. What should they do if they want to get in contact?
Yeah. So, you can follow us on all the social media as well. We're on the X and Instagram and Facebook at CASA Media, CASAA Media. I think there might be an underscore in there or not. Try it both ways. You'll find us. There are other organizations with a similar acronym. So don't get us confused with something that doesn't have smoke-free alternatives in the name. If anybody wants to send me an email, I am aclark@casa.org. International folks can still kind of join. Our system is set up mainly, we are dealing exclusively with American lawmakers and officials. So you may have to kind of, fib on your zip code in order to become a member. That would sort of get you on our mailing list for any of the news stuff that we put out. But most of that you can find on social media. Kristen Noel Marsh manages that for us and now is a volunteer as well. Keeping up with the news and the things that we're seeing in the headlines, that's best done probably through Facebook and Twitter.
Fantastic. Highly recommend everyone to follow. Very, very cool social media channels which you have, so I really enjoy those too. And you have very cool t-shirts in your shop, I have to mention too. Thank you again for joining us. It was a great pleasure. Wish you all the best and thanks again.
Thank you.